We've all been treated to a barrage of political commercials in the past few weeks. The high cost of producing and placing TV commercials is one of the reasons election campaigns are getting more and more expensive. Where campaign money comes from and what political favors are owed in return is the subject of a new book by Brooks Jackson. He's an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal, where he covers money in politics. You can tell by the title of his new book, Honest Graft, what he thinks of the current system for regulating political donations from individuals and special interest groups. Jackson accuses the system of offering perverse incentives to legislators. Those who cater to the well-funded are rewarded. Those who challenge the status quo are punished. Brooks Jackson might not approve of the system, but he does find reporting on campaign financing a fascinating business.
Well, my fascination comes from the fact that this is part of the process. This is the what shapes the underlying, what is the underlying context of our government. I think money plays an enormous role in what happens in Congress, what happens in our elections, and indirectly, therefore, what happens in the everyday lives of ordinary citizens.
Do you think that there's more pressure on political parties and political campaigners to get money than there ever used to be because finance costs have gotten so expensive?
Oh, there's absolutely no question about it. Now, there is this overwhelming appetite for money in Washington today. I have, as a reporter, covered this for many years, since before Watergate, back in the days when they used to pass cash around in brown paper bags. And after Watergate, we supposedly reformed the system and regularized political action committees, required disclosure. But in many ways, the present system is worse. It now costs about $500,000 for a House candidate to win an election where there's really any competition. That's just the average in the last election. And you have to raise that, unless you can finance it out of your own pocket, which very few people can do, in amounts of no more than $1,000. That means that a candidate for the House of Representatives, whether they're an incumbent or a challenger, has to spend enormous amounts of time raising the amount of money that's required to get through to the voters today.
Why are campaigns so much more expensive now? Is it because of media time, pollsters?
Well, some people will say it's because there's more money available and it's a matter of more available dollars simply being spent because lobbyists have so much more money to give now than they did 10 or 15 years ago that it's always going to be spent if it's available. There's something to that. But also, it is simply more expensive to run for several reasons. What we've done is to take our politics today from what used to be a labor-intensive enterprise where you had lots and lots of volunteers and there wasn't a whole lot of money spent, to a capital-intensive enterprise where one purchases television time, radio time, and the costs of that, by the way, have gone up faster than the general rate of inflation. One buys computer-driven mail, And postage becomes very expensive, sending thousands and thousands of fundraising letters or campaign flyers, consultants, polling. All the modern paraphernalia for getting elected to office today is just simply enormously expensive. And that's something you can't repeal, you can't change by law, you simply have to deal with.
So a lot of the money for the campaigns come from special interest groups, and the special interest groups get what in return for their money?
Well, that is the question that will probably be debated endlessly. I'll give you my view of it. And as one who has covered this for many years, as one who for a brief time during the 1986 elections was allowed to sit inside the Democratic Party's reelection machinery for House members and also inside the Republican Party's campaign committee. I think that special interest groups get a number of things. They get access. They get privileged access. In fact, the parties are marketing special access to their lawmakers in return for campaign contributions. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has what it calls a speaker's club, where an individual for $5,000 a year or a political action committee for $15,000 a year gets, well, they have a regular brochure that tells you what you get. You get special briefings, you get luggage tags, you get golf outings with the Speaker of the House, at least they did when Tip O'Neill was speaker. I don't know that Jim Wright's a golfer, but I believe beyond that, beyond access, special interest groups that give money, and this is not just political action committees, by the way, this by special interest, a special interest donor can be an individual as well, and mm-hmm. there are many Wall Street executives and tax shelter syndicators, oil men, real estate developers, all manner of people who, although they don't give through political action committees, have very special legislative interests. I believe these people are able to purchase, not votes necessarily. I did not see, I have never seen very much of an outright quid pro quo, a corrupt vote-buying operation. If I could prove it, I would have probably a criminal case, not just a good news story. But what contributors buy is almost a quasi-constituent status. A donor from Arizona might, in effect, become a constituent of a senator from Michigan or a congressman from New Jersey by virtue of giving them a couple of $1,000s. And I was able to see this happening. Tony Coelho, who was chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and who, in the process of researching Honest Graft, I was able to engage in some remarkably candid interviews. At least they amazed me with their candor. Explained it once. He told a story, which I relate in the book, about a donor who had given, he was a member of the Speaker's Club, he'd given $5,000, and he wanted a favor. He wanted help with some petty governmental concern. Doesn't really matter what, but Tony was most anxious to help him. Sent him to one subcommittee chairman, sent him to another subcommittee chairman. The fellow came back unsatisfied and said, the way Tony Coelho told it, "I expected better treatment from this. I gave you money, and I expected better treatment from this." Well, at that point, Tony Coelho said, I became indignant. I told him, your money hasn't bought you anything. I gave him his money back and threw him out of the office. Well, I thought this, he says, you know, I told him, don't ever say that your money has bought you anything. If you say it, it's all over. Now, to Congressman Coelho, he was throwing the fellow out of his office in righteous indignation. But to me, the story said something differently. He was... And I think this is a common ethical code among members of Congress. It's peculiar to an outsider, but quite common to the lawmakers. It is perfectly all right for them, in their minds, to do a favor for a campaign contributor, even though he might not be a constituent. He might not have anything to do with the interests of the congressman or senator's constituents. Perfectly all right to do favors for them. But the unforgivable thing is ever to suggest that by virtue of their money, they are entitled to those favors. A very peculiar sort of way of drawing the line.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Brooks Jackson, and he reports on campaign financing for the Wall Street Journal. That's the subject of his new book, which is called Honest Graft. Now, there are laws limiting the amount of money that any individual or any political action committee can donate to a candidate. That's called hard money. But then there's also something called soft money, and soft money is a way of circumventing the rules that exist about donations. What are some examples of how you can give money that surpasses the legal limits?
Well, soft money is basically everything but what you see disclosed at the Federal Election Commission. And everything but the money that falls strictly under the federal limits, and there's a lot of it. Both campaigns now, both presidential campaigns for Mr. Dukakis and Mr. Bush are accepting $100,000 checks from donors who are able to afford to write checks that large. They run not to the through the campaign committees of the candidates. That would be illegal. In the presidential race, they can only take public money, and that's it, and there are limits to what the campaign itself directly can spend. But the political party, whether it's the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, has numerous ways of using an individual donor's money, or for that matter, a corporation or a labor union's money, to advance the cause of their presidential candidate and all other candidates. They can, for example, use it for get-out-the-vote drives that benefit an entire ticket. There are more ways that they can get around the law than we have time to go into here, but the practical effect is, and the interesting fact is, that the limits that we thought we were enacting after Watergate back in 1974 are, for all practical purposes, now a dead letter. There are simply so many ways around them. And that's true right down to the House level, right down to the congressional candidate level. One of the examples I give in Honest Graft is that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee was able to finance construction of an entire new television studio with soft money through what they called a building fund, which our regulators had decided, rightly or wrongly, didn't count as campaign contributions under the election law. Well, that studio then was used to churn out TV and radio commercials, which the committee gave to its candidates free of charge, and essentially turned into campaign contributions, perhaps not in a legal way, but certainly in a practical way.
You write a little bit about the techniques that politicians have for getting PACs or special interest groups to give them money. And you say that it's almost like a legal version of the old protection racket. You quote a letter that Tony Coelho, who was at the time the chairman of the Democratic Finance Committee, this was 1986 when you were researching the book, this is a letter that he sent to the National Association of Home Builders, to their PAC. And the letter said, the NAHB has a good relationship with Democrats in the House, and we would like to see that relationship continue and grow. Your action in this race causes us to be concerned that the relationship will be damaged.
Well, it's almost as though they were saying, it's a nice little trade association you've got here. Too bad if anything would happen to it. It is a little bit like the old protection racket, and it's a curious thing. Reporters like myself who cover campaign finance have been writing stories for years that I think to many people suggest that what's going on is a form of legalized bribery where special interest donors force money into the hands of candidates and trying to buy their votes. And to a certain extent, there is some of that going on. But the untold story, and I think what I try to get at in Honest Graft, is that there is a shakedown aspect to this. The candidates are quite vigorously going out seeking money from special interest donors because, by the way, our laws do encourage them to do that. They're set up in such a perverse way that you can take more money, you can take $5,000 from a political action committee that has perhaps a very narrow legislative agenda, but only $1,000 from your Aunt Minnie. It's crazy. As a result, candidates, this includes incumbents, challengers, those going in open seats, because of the enormous cost of getting elected, because of this enormous appetite that they have for money, are pursuing special interest groups, business corporations, trade associations, labor unions, ideological groups, to an extent and with a vigor that has just become unseemly.
In yesterday's Wall Street Journal, you had a front page article on honorariums. And, you know, when I think of an honorarium, I always thought, well, you're invited to speak to a group and you give a speech and they pay you a small fee in return. But honorariums in the world of politics don't mean that anymore. What does it mean?
Well, they have undergone a change over the last 5 to 10 years. Today, an honorarium is, and I don't think I'm putting it too bluntly, for the most part, a tool for buying access, a tool that lobbyists now use for purchasing a few minutes of a lawmaker's time. I'll give you a couple of examples. There are trade associations today, the American Trucking Association is one, the Tobacco Institute is another, that have regular programs where they have breakfast maybe once every couple of weeks in a forum, a place one or two blocks away from the Capitol. And they will invite a member of Congress over to give remarks, 10, 15 minutes at the most, to answer a few questions from people. This will be a group of lobbyists from the Trade Association, perhaps a few executives from members of the Trade Association. No real preparation required, just off-the-cuff remarks and answer a few questions, and the lawmaker can walk back to his office before the first committee hearing of the day either $1,000 or $2,000 richer. Typically, a senator gets $2,000 and a congressman gets $1,000 for one of these things, although it's getting so that even a freshman congressman can command a $2,000 fee for a very brief appearance.
So basically, you show up for a little while and you get paid. So
well, exactly right. And there are attorneys who are becoming worried that this is so blatant today that the fee, which used to be for giving a real speech that one might even have written oneself, it's now becoming so openly just a fee for showing up and being lobbied that some a vigorous prosecutor one day might construe this as bribery and bring a case. And you know, in the story in yesterday's paper, I relate that Mr. William Weld, who came into town from Boston, where he had put an awful lot of crooked policemen and building inspectors in jail as the U.S. attorney up there, opened his paper one day, discovered that several lawmakers had been on a plane trip to Virginia, paid for by United Coal Company, and were paid about $2,000 apiece to tour coal mines down there. Well, he immediately thought he had a criminal case and was shocked to learn that this was all legal.
Apparently, in a lot of states now, candidates are using these honorarium as a weapon against their opponent. For instance, you quote a couple of ads in your article. Representative Robert Davis of Michigan, while he sat on the Armed Services Committee, was paid $17,000 in personal appearance fees by defense suppliers, and his election opponent is running a television commercial about the payment, saying, "What Bob Davis has done is not illegal, but does that make it right?" Now that this is becoming public and opponents are accusing people who are running for election are accusing their opponents of accepting money like this in unethical ways, do you think that it might help put a stop to it?
Well, yes, I think there will be a move in Congress next year to abolish honoraria. It's becoming they're becoming such an embarrassment now that that there are a number of members who would like to get rid of them. But so many lawmakers have come to depend on these special interest fees for extra income that it's probably going to require a rather substantial pay increase to get them to go along with that. Now, the Wall Street Journal did a poll not long ago asking people who, I think about two-thirds of the people we queried said, yes, they should outlaw honoraria, but about 80% said, no, they shouldn't get a pay raise in return for doing it. But I'll tell you, these honoraria fees are, I think, the clearest and most blatant example of what I call honest graft that you can find. It's not illegal, but that doesn't make it right.
Well, I want to talk with you about campaign financing of the current election, of the presidential election, but first we're going to take a short break. Brooks Jackson is my guest. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he reports on campaign financing and the use of money by lobby groups. That's also the subject of his new book, an investigation called Honest Graft. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wall Street Journal reporter Brooks Jackson, and we're discussing his new book, Honest Graft, which is about campaign financing and the use of money by lobby groups. Let's talk about the current campaign. Let's talk about the presidential elections. In the vice presidential debate between Benson and Quayle, the subject of Benson's Breakfast Club was raised. Give us a brief summary of what the Breakfast Club was about, and if where Benson stands now in campaign financing.
Well, Senator Benson, first of all, I understand, is chairman of the Finance Committee, which writes our tax laws and therefore is a real magnet for business money. Every corporation, every trade association in the country has some interest in what goes on on the Finance Committee. And nobody can afford to be frozen out of the Finance Committee. Senator Benson, shortly after the 1986 elections, announced that he would institute a formal program of breakfast briefings for lobbyists who were doing business before the Finance Committee. and who also agreed through their political action committees to give the maximum legal amount of money to his campaign, which is $10,000. That's $5,000 for the primary, in which he was unopposed, and $5,000, I believe he was unopposed, and $5,000 for the general. When the Washington Post got a hold of the story, and it was a wonderful scoop for them, I regret I didn't have it first myself, he said he had made a real doozy of a mistake, and he immediately disbanded the Breakfast Club, gave back the money, and washed his hands of it. Now, most all those who had given and who got their money back turned around and within a few weeks or months had still given the legal maximum, $10,000. Today, Senator Benson has exceeded all previous records for accepting political action committee money. He's up to nearly $2,500,000, I think, as of mid-October. And the curious thing is, he was only building on what had happened 2 years earlier when Senator Packwood, the Republican who then headed the Finance Committee, when Republicans were in control, had a breakfast club of his own. He only charged $5,000, if memory serves, and was not unduly criticized for it. Certainly didn't disband it. It was when the fee went up to $10,000 that it attracted attention.
Any major differences in fundraising style or in amount of money fundraised between the Bush-Quayle ticket and the Dukakis-Benson ticket?
Well, this is extremely difficult to get a real handle on. It appears for all practical purposes, both the Republican candidate and the Democratic candidate have plenty of money. They've got enough. They probably have more than enough. And certainly money is not going to be a factor in the outcome of the general election. Briefly, both candidates receive from the public treasury about $46 million in public funds. This is the system of public financing we enacted after Watergate, which was supposed to limit the role of private donors and end the practice of selling ambassadorships for campaign contributions and that sort of thing. Both political parties also will spend about $8 million in direct support of the of their candidates, mostly through buying television ads. This is what's called coordinated expenditures. It's money that's raised from private sources under federal limits and expended by the parties in direct support of their candidates. Beyond that, there's this enormous area of soft money in which both parties are vigorously pursuing large donations, small donations, anything they can get their hands on, to spend in ways that will aid the candidates indirectly, voter registration, get out the vote, generic advertising that says vote Republican or vote Democratic, that sort of thing. Nobody really knows how much, $30, $40 million more, perhaps. It's possible that the Democrats this time will actually outspend the Republicans, but because most of this money goes outside the ordinary channels where it's disclosed at the Federal Election Commission, it is not exactly given in secret, but so hard to track that you really can't say who's going to spend the most.
You've given some thought to campaign finance reform. Let's discuss some of the reforms you'd like to see put into effect. First of all, you'd like to abolish honoraria.
Well, absolutely.
And you think that that's actually possible? That might actually happen in the near future. Let's move on to PACs. You'd also like to abolish PACs?
Well, no. What I would suggest, and I as a reporter, I feel sometimes hesitant to suggest solutions. But I think once I've raised all these problems and said it's I think it's a terrible scandal. I feel obliged to say what I would do about it. So as a matter, I make a few suggestions, and I hope that it gets discussion started, because discussions have been pretty much deadlocked. I think both parties are kind of locked into positions. They don't want to see any change that would give the other party an advantage. But if I were writing a campaign finance law, here's what I would do. First of all, I would prohibit political action committees from making campaign contributions to candidates. I would find another role for them. Let them go out and register voters. Let them go out and involve people in the process with their money in ways that are apart from putting money in the campaigns of candidates. I would prohibit candidates, in fact, from accepting money from any source but two. One would be their own party. I don't see any way that a political party can corrupt its own candidate, and yet we have in laws today pretty strict limits on what a party can do for its own candidates. $55,000, roughly, is about all the Democratic or Republican Party can spend directly for one of its own House candidates. That's about a tenth of what it costs. So our laws force our candidates to turn to other sources for their money. I think that's wrong. I would raise all those limits. I would do away with those limits. I would allow parties to spend unlimited amounts of money in direct support of their own candidates. And I would also prohibit candidates from accepting money, again, from anybody but their own party or from individuals within their own state. I don't see how a New York tax shelter promoter should have a right to influence the election of a Nevada congressman or a Georgia senator. And yet that happens every day under our present system. Very quickly, I would subsidize the parties. I would put public money into them and find other ways of getting more money into challengers' races. We don't have... In the last election, 98% of all House incumbents were reelected. And one of the reasons that incumbents have become almost challenger-proof is that our campaign finance laws really restrict challengers from mounting effective campaigns and holding incumbents accountable. We have to change that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Brooks Jackson. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal and the author of the new book, Honest Graft, about campaign financing. It's published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.